and welcome to Jazz Vignettes from the Hall. I am Fawn Fritzen. In this special series, music enthusiast Steve Gedrose explores the world of jazz from its roots to the present day. He breaks the fascinating, ever-evolving genre of jazz into easily digestible themes, backed up, of course, with plenty of music examples. In each episode, Steve will introduce you to the musicians who were or are some of the key driving forces behind the evolution of jazz music. We recorded Steve's presentations live at the beautiful Old Fire Hall in downtown Whitehorse, Yukon. Annually, between October and April, Jazz Yukon presents the Jazz in the Hall series, 5 concerts featuring local jazz groups. Each event is opened with a presentation by Steve, where he provides some background about the live music performed that evening. Our first episode is titled The History of Early Jazz. Steve delves into the origins of jazz in New Orleans, Louisiana, illustrated with music samples from Scott Joplin, Jelly Roll Morton, Big Spiderbeck, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and the king of them all, Louis Armstrong. Here is Steve Gedrose.
I thought I would talk tonight about early jazz, or traditional jazz, it's commonly known as now. This evolved from New Orleans, Louisiana, roughly around the turn of the century, beginning of 1900s. So I just wanted to start with a brief timeline, kind of how this is in context. So as we know, New Orleans is a port, and it's a real melting pot of all kinds of different cultures. We had French culture, we have the black slaves, we have European settlers, people from the rest of the South settled there. I'd like to set this up by talking about how the population developed there. From the 1600s to the 1860s, hundreds of thousands of African slaves were captured in West Africa and shipped to the Americas. Many of these folks ended up in New Orleans. And by the 1750s, slaves made up 20% of the population of British North America, some 240,000 people. I was sure astonished by those kind of numbers. These workers were generally used in the sugar and cotton crops and plantations throughout the southern United States. These crops required that there be a lot of hand labor, and slaves fit that bill, unfortunately. New Orleans was founded in 1718 by the French Mississippi Company, so we have an influx of French culture into the mix. And large populations of Creoles evolved. Creoles, the name has had many connotations through the years, but the connotation that I'm using is basically mixed race people. These were generally the offspring of French slave masters. They're significant because when the slave owners died, they often freed the slaves. So these were people of mixed race that had freedom to work and travel wherever they wanted and things, which is certainly different from the experience of the black slaves. This allowed Creoles to become educated, and they certainly were integrated into the culture and society in New Orleans. New Orleans had the first opera company in North America, so they were involved with creating the music for that. New Orleans existed in kind of a three-tier society. There were the whites, the blacks, and the mixed race. They all had kind of similar status. This was really unusual, particularly in the South. In 1764, the Spaniards came in. There was an agreement between Spain and France called the Treaty of Paris that was signed in 1763. And in 64, they took over the control of New Orleans. They had a different model in mind. Theirs was more of a two-tier model, blacks and whites. So all of a sudden, Creoles kind of lost their social status and basically had to go out and find other things to do. So the Creoles were highly trained as musicians, so they began putting together minstrel troupes. They worked on the river boats. They really were the predecessors and the inventors of jazz. In 1867, I'm jumping ahead a bit here, but after the Civil War, which is about slavery, of course, the 15th Amendment was passed. This gave citizenship to men born in the U.S., which the notable exception of Native Americans, I find that pretty awful, but that's how it was. So the freed slaves could now vote. This gave them a lot more power, a lot more status in the community. So as a result of this, northern religious societies founded a bunch of black universities in the states, in the southern states particularly. One significant one was Fisk University that was established in Tennessee. And in 1871, the Jubilee Singers from the Fisk University presented a concert tour. This marked the first time that white Americans were really exposed to the work songs and spirituals from the Black American culture, the emerging Black American culture. 1890, so we're getting close to Gold Rush time, early jazz started to appear in the Spanish-controlled city now of New Orleans. I should mention that generally there's a lot of French still spoken. The Creole spoke a version of French. French Quarter, as you know, is still the heart of music in New Orleans. The French influence remained strong, and a lot of the early jazz groups were using instruments left over from French military bands. So that's kind of how they had cornets and tubas and the like kicking around. We're getting up to 1900 here, and ragtime comes in a big way. It has syncopated rhythms and really began to capture the hearts of Americans. Musicians were playing on the riverboats that traveled up and down the Mississippi and spread the music through that method, and then leading later to a mass exodus, really, from the South to industrialized northern towns, particularly Chicago. There's a growing sheet music industry, and also people were making piano rolls, so people could start to listen to this stuff at home. This is prior to recording, of course. Between 1900 and 1911, ragtime was the most popular music in America. So jazz really had a popular connotation in those days. It's kind of lost that as we move through time, but certainly in the day, it was the popular music of the time. It took influences from marching band music, from blues, definitely was the predecessor to jazz. It varies in that it was through composed. In other words, there's no improvised parts. All the parts are written out. Everybody plays their parts, and that all works. So the first musical example I'd like to give is a tune that I'm sure is familiar to lots of people, particularly if you've been to the Frantic Follies, because they play music from this period. It's Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag. If you could just play track one for me, Jim. Taste of that. Scott Joplin was considered the king of ragtime writers. It was his mission to take piano music from lowly entertainment that was in saloons and brothels and bring it into an American art form that was played in the concert hall. He certainly had great success in that area. Scott Joplin was self-taught on piano as a youth, but he did eventually receive some instruction from a German-born teacher who introduced him to European classical music. In 1891, he was age 23. He worked at the minstrel troupe. So once again, we see this pattern of people working through the minstrel troupes, essentially a traveling band that went around the South and played music for different audiences. His first publications came in 1895. In 1896, he enrolled in another Negro university that was set up at the time, George R. Smith College, where he finally studied music in a formal way. This allowed him to notate all his music and certainly helped his compositional skills as well. In 1899, he composed the song we just heard, Maple Leaf Rag, and later in 1901, published one of his most famous songs called The Entertainer. This was revived, I think it was 1973, in the movie The Sting, so he had a jolt to his career. That was published under his own publishing company, which was very ahead of the curve. He was very clever that way, and received royalties for The Entertainer for most of his life. I'd like to move to a guy that I spoke about last week. This is a piano player from the New Orleans area called Jelly Roll Morton. He lived from 1890 to 1941. And was a serious character. He wore very fancy clothes, flashy clothes. He had a tooth filled with a diamond. He was a braggart and tried to convince everybody through his whole life that he had invented jazz in 1902 and that many of his original compositions were stolen from him and used by other people for their own glory. This is in doubt, but nobody doubts the outstanding contribution he made with his music. I'd just like to play a tune now called Black Bottom Stomp. This was recorded in 1926. Number two, please, Jim. So you hear now what an arranger Jelly Roll was. These were all composed parts. Nobody is really improvising. He's written out all the parts, but it's just incredible how the different instruments interact with each other. I think that was a real gift that he had. He started traveling throughout the United States, as I mentioned last time. And after the 20s, kind of in the towards the 30s, Depression era, his music was really considered old-fashioned, and he really had a hard time to make a living. He didn't have the money to hire proper sidemen, so his music suffered in that way. And he went along kind of kicking around town to town throughout the states until about 1938, he was championed by a guy called Alan Lomax. Alan Lomax recorded all kinds of different music for the Library of Congress, including a bunch of piano music and conversation from Jelly Roll Morton. My friend Grant Simpson has a set of this music, and the interviews are just incredible. He was such a colorful guy with such colorful language. It's really quite remarkable. And he just goes through and kind of shows the history of jazz piano. His playing is still great. This is close to the end of his life, but he still had his chops, and continuing to claim that he was really the architect of the entire style. He moved to Los Angeles in 1940. But his health was failing, and he died the next summer in 1941. The ironic part was that his music was really revitalized in this period, and had he stuck around longer, had he been able to live longer, he would have had another shot at success, monetary success. I'd like to now talk about a group that was a white group. So as a result of that, their career went faster than the black groups that they would be competing with. They're not the best group ever, but they were significant because they were the first group to record a jazz record. This was made in 1917. The tune was the Livery Stable Blues, which was a huge hit. It's basically a novelty tune where the horns are kind of imitating barnyard instruments and things like that. So it's kind of a goofy tune, but it really caught on. They say that this song was one of the first songs to achieve million-dollar status. So in those years when there's much less population than we have now, that was incredibly significant. I don't have a version of that song, but I have one called The Sensation Rag that was also a big song for them, and that was recorded in 1920. This one is track four, Jim. Jim. So you get a taste of that. These guys were influenced by the black groups in New Orleans. They, like I said, they weren't the first group to play jazz. Actually, a cornet player in New Orleans called Buddy Bolden had been playing jazz or a form of jazz for about almost 20 years by this point. But they were significant, like I said, because they were the first to be recorded. They were recorded by Columbia. They did a couple of tracks called Darktown Strutter's Ball, which is a well-known early jazz tune, and Indiana. But Columbia was just a little afraid to put these out. They just thought there would be some racial problems and didn't put it out. Victor stepped in and recorded them. And as I mentioned, they recorded Livery Stable Blues. And on the flip side was a piece called Dixie Jazz Band One Step. And this was a huge record and really had a lot to do with making jazz more prominent throughout the states. I'd like to talk about a guy now who was very much influenced by the original Dixieland Jazz Band. That's a fellow called Bix Beiderbecke. By the name, you can tell that he is German descent. He's a white guy. He lived between 1903 and 1931, so he passed at the age of 28, which is a real shame because he was a wonderful cornet player and a terrific jazz player. He was very much influenced by the Dixieland group that came before him. I should just mention a bit about Dixieland. It's really ensemble music. You don't have individual soloists, as we've come to know in later jazz styles. It kind of sounds like everybody's soloing all at once, and essentially that's what's going on. There's not a lot of improvisation. It's all the parts are figured out ahead, so it's like I say, it's an ensemble piece. Bix is really starting to break away from that. He's starting to add some cornet solos, and even though the rest of the ensemble is going, you can tell that he's playing a different part. He's starting to improvise and starting to give a real jazz flavor to this music. So that's number three, please, Jim. This one's called The Royal Garden Blues. To mention that this is one of the first popular songs that's built on a riff. In other words, you have this da 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 da, da and the rest of the song is basically variations on that theme. This is a thing that's common in classical music, but really wasn't heard of much in popular music prior to this time. And this band was really significant for the people that were in it. Joe Venuti was a really well-known jazz violinist. The other guy that was in this band was Frank Tram Trumbauer. Now he is once again, German descent, white guy who played alto sax. He was a very influential player. People like Lester Young, who became a huge tenor sax star in the swing era with Count Basie and others, listened to Tram because, as Lester said, he told a story. He sang a story in his solos, and that was really influential to a lot of different players. Bix, as I mentioned, was a really heavy drinker. And there's a lot of speculation that this was the time of prohibition in the United States. The quality of the booze went right downhill, and a lot of people figure that that's eventually what killed Mr. Beiderbecke, as I said, at the tender age of 28. So it's a real tragedy. He had a lot to offer, and it's too bad that he didn't get a longer time to play around and make this music even more available than it was at this time. Okay, so now I'd like to go to my last example. This is the king of all, Louis Armstrong. He is certainly known as a jazz singer and trumpet player, cornet player originally. He is probably one of the most famous jazz musicians in the world, and he had his start, of course, in New Orleans. His birth is uncertain, but a lot of people claim he was born on the 4th of July, 1900. So that kind of is as American as you can get. He had many nicknames, but the ones he is mostly known by are Pops and Satchmo. Pops, because of his huge influence on all the jazz players to come after him. And Satchmo was a contraction of satchel mouth because he had a really big mouth. So essentially, these stuck with him, and I think he became very fond of them and referred to himself as Pops. The other thing you'll hear him say, I think in this song and a lot of songs, is Gates. Well, the significance of Gates is Gates swing. And he said, come on, Gates swing, you know. So if he just shortened that later to just say Gates. Gates, Gates, and that's what he's talking about. This is a very famous song written by W.C. Handy from Memphis. It was first published in 1914. This version was recorded when Louis was traveling in Paris. This was recorded in 1934, St. Louis Blues. Number five, Jim.
Long as I can be. Now my guy got a heart like rock in the sea. Oh, bleed my soul, my baby's trying to quit me. Got St. Louis just as long as I can be. Oh, bleed my soul, my baby's trying to quit me. Swing out that line out. Now hearing from Brother Chittison.
So you just hear that amazing vocal style. He's singing like he would be playing it on the horn. In fact, a lot of his vocals, he's kind of doing a duet with himself. He'll sing the melody line, then kind of add some filigree at the end to kind of as a counterpoint. Just a remarkable guy. He had very little formal training. He learned how to play the horn in a boy's home, basically, when he was young. He was busted for some offense. They put him in this home, and he learned how to play the cornet, and the rest is history. He just had such a huge influence on popular music. He was kind of a controversial figure in the black American scene. Some people saw him as kind of selling out to whites and clowning and goofing around and kind of doing things that were not dignified. But at the same time, he was respected because he really made it one of the biggest players in the white entertainment industry. So he's significant for that reason and for many others. I think later on, he just played and played and played and eventually blew his lip. He had several times where he was instructed by his doctors not to play the horn at all, which was really hard for him. But then he just developed his singing style. And a lot of people in the 50s and the later part of his career just knew him as a singer and didn't really realize that he had this huge history from the 20s as one of the most virtuosic trumpet players to ever come down the pike. Subsequent series, I'd like to kind of take this further. The next show will be about swing music and following that bebop as we just move towards the modern day. That's about it for me. So thanks very much. That's just an introduction to traditional jazz. Thank you.
You have been listening to the first installment of Jazz Vignettes from the Hall, titled The History of Early Jazz. We recorded this presentation in November 2010. We still have time for a couple of classics recorded in 1926 by Louis Armstrong and his Hot Five. First up is Cornet Chop Suey, a tune written by Louis. This is followed by Kid Ory's tune Muskrat Ramble, featuring Kid Ory on trombone. This program was made possible by Jazz Yukon. Jazz Yukon is a volunteer organization that promotes and presents jazz in the Yukon through an annual integrated program of live jazz presentations and jazz education outreach. This episode was researched, written, and presented live by Steve Gedros. Live recording by Jim Holland. Dieter Gade is our producer, and I am Fawn Fritzen. Thank you for listening.